This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and there are now 63 cities and towns designated as high risk for the coronavirus in Massachusetts. That is 23 more than last week. When the list was originally released, there were four. And this is the seven-day average. Positive coronavirus test rate in Massachusetts is at its highest point since August at 1.3%. These trends raise a number of questions about whether we know how to and effectively can stop a second surge of the virus and what the other costs to our communities of doing so might be. We plan to have joining us the mayor of Somerville, Joe Curtatone. Somerville had one of the most conservative approaches to reopening in the state and entered the high-risk zone this week. I need to check and see, do we have Mayor Curtatone on the line? Great. So Mayor Curtatone joins us now. Mayor Joel Curtatone, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
So Mayor Curtatone, Somerville was one of 27 cities and towns newly added to the state's list of high-risk communities last night. What do you think is behind that? Why did that happen?
Well, you know, despite Somerville's very deliberate and probably the most diligent, methodical approach to reopening in the Commonwealth, what we've seen in the Boston metropolitan areas, a consistency in higher numbers of positive cases, even as the governor has allowed for a move into phases 3.1 and 3.2, where we have resisted based on data and expertise. And the later part, 3.2, allows for higher occupancy numbers and activities, such as indoor and outdoor performance venues, allowing to be up to 50% or 250 people. Again, while Somerville has been careful and measured in its reopening, it's important to remember that the virus knows no boundaries, knows no borders. We're still a part of this metropolitan area. We have but many of the communities that are already high risk. And again, we're not only the most densely populated community in New England, we're part of one of the most densely populated regions in the country. So we're not surprised that we've ticked into the red category. We predicted this. We've established a process and framework to analyze our data, to monitor how the virus is evolving, and we've been prepared for this for a while because it's all been part of our effort to prepare for the resurgence.
So there have been some businesses in Somerville and other places who have argued that this phased reopening that you're talking about, and Somerville did approach it more cautiously and more slowly, these stages of reopening, that is fundamentally too painful to the economic bottom line. Now that we're in a place where you've done that, but Somerville is still seeing the increases and still entering into the red zone, does that mean it may be time for a different strategy? And might a different strategy take a different approach economically?
Well, what it doesn't mean is just having against the advice of expertise and caution is to just open up activities to the extent we've seen in this region. We now have, from last week, an increase of 23 communities that are in the red. I'd submit Somerville's approach has been prudent and has been impactful. We have a lower positivity rate than the majority of the Commonwealth, but we still have 42 people that died. And let's remember that we cannot have a sustainable recovery of our economy without a healthy society. Almost 9,500 people have passed away in the Commonwealth. Over 215,000, over 217,000 now in the nation. People continue to become infected, continue to become ill, and they're going to continue to die. So I'd submit the approach we've taken is one that should be aligned as a coordinated regional approach. And it's not the measures that are slowing our economy or bringing it or brought it down. It's the pandemic. It's not really a response to the pandemic. And that's important to remember. Until we have a full or on our way to a full recovery from this health crisis and people have confidence that we're able to do that and people stop becoming ill and dying, we're not going to have a sustainable recovery of the economy.
So I was a little surprised to hear you say that. I want to check in with you. Are you saying that even if we had not scaled back and the phases had not been what they were, we would still be seeing this kind of economic impact because the virus itself would create it?
The resulting recession to the economy is a consequence of the pandemic, not the measures taken. And that's fact. That's fact. Because, many of our businesses are suffering from a lack of consumer confidence and lack of confidence that we have the proper safety measures in place and a strong concern that if they go out and frequent those businesses, such as restaurants or other establishments, we have large gatherings, they may become ill. So That is fact. That's not just the premise that Somerville is based its actions upon. Our job is to make sure we are guided by two stars, to ensure that whatever activity we decide to reopen, and we're going to continue on this strategy, is that we do so in a way that it continues to ensure the health and safety, well-being in everybody in our community, and that any phase of reopening is sustainable. Faced with the Commonwealth now being in the rate, Somerville ticked up to 8.2. Average cases per day over the last 2 weeks. That's going to come back down, and as we predicted weeks ago, it's going to go back and forth for cities around the Commonwealth. But the Commonwealth is at 8.6, so by its own measure, the Commonwealth is a high-risk state.
And this is just for listeners, Mayor Curtatone, that's per 100,000 people,
right?
Correct.
So the Commonwealth uses a measurement, which I don't totally agree with, because it's one point of data, but by its own measurement, if you average 8 cases or more per 100,000 population on a two-week average, you're in the red. You're categorized as red. We're at 8.2. The Commonwealth at 8.6.
Let me stop you there, if I could. And I'm sorry. I know there's a lot to say here, but I have a lot of questions for you, too. With those numbers in mind, it's a compound question. Have you thought about actually scaling back rather than just pausing where you are? And are you talking, I know we've had you on the air about your regional strategy with Tufts University and Medford. What about a larger regional response with the cities and towns around you and with the governor? Are you in that kind of coordination?
That coordination, thank you for bringing up, does not exist. And that's what we need to do. From the beginning of this pandemic, municipal leaders in cities and towns, like some of them, like myself, have clamored for an integrated, coordinated, collaborative approach in response to the pandemic. We're part of one densely populated region. You have 351 cities and towns, in essence, implementing 351 responses to the pandemic. That can't happen, and we cannot achieve success. Somerville, I'd submit, has set a standard to the response, along with other communities, being the first to institute mandatory mask orders for indoor or outdoor activities, and its approach to analyzing and deliberateness to analyzing the reopening of any economic activities. We've instituted measures in our incident command team in response to measure and analyze different points of data, whether it's positive tests, whether it's analyzing, the evidence of any infection within our sewer system and wastewater, measuring that. But we're on it on our own. And what we've seen in other states is, when I submit in states like New York, is they've done it on a regional approach. You cannot separate the impact in every community from each other within the region. What happens in Somerville certainly matters in Salem. What happens in Lynn certainly matters in Framingham and so forth.
So what could the state do differently?
One of the most densely populated regions in the United States, essential workers travel on the same transit systems. They're interacting with one another.
So what could the state do differently, and what could the cities and towns that neighbor Somerville do differently to allow for that level of coordination?
Well, first, there has to be commitment for that level of coordination. I submit that is there, and absolutely there, from cities and towns. I chair the Metropolitan Mayors Coalition. I facilitate, along with Kim Driscoll, who chairs the North Shore Coalition. Those are the CEOs and mayors and managers from those particular regions. And since the beginning of this pandemic, we've facilitated regional coordination calls and meetings amongst the leaders of our communities here and across the Commonwealth. And one of the consistent themes has been, we need a plan. We need a plan that is transparent, but coordinated and integrated amongst the regions and the Commonwealth. We need to make very clear to each other and the public how we're basing our decisions. What indicators drive a decision to open up a part of our economy or to roll it back? To go back to your original question, we here have undertaken that approach, and we will analyze all the data. And the important thing is, if there's a source that is contributing to high numbers or an outbreak, then we act strategically to contain that source. Right now, there is nothing that is popping out saying it's this particular activity or that. It appears to be what is a consistent theme we're seeing in the Commonwealth and the country, and most in the Commonwealth is in familial settings that seems to be contributing to the high ticket numbers, and that's probably the case around the Commonwealth. But we still have absent a regional approach. And without that approach, we're going to continue to have this varying degrees of response, communities coming in and out of different color schemes. And I know it's more of a whack-a-mole approach, and I don't think that's going to be effective moving forward.
So last question for you, Mayor. In the spring, the governor was clear that the goal wasn't to eliminate infections, but instead to limit them as much as possible to ensure that we had the necessary healthcare capacity to respond. That is a surge goal. What is the right everyday goal?
Well, first, I do want to commend the governor and the administration and everyone in the Commonwealth for stepping up at the beginning, because at the beginning of the pandemic, correct, we wanted to limit the amount of infections as possible and maintain the stability of our healthcare system, because if had it collapsed like it did in northern Italy, it would have meant lives. So we did a very good job of flattening on the curve and maintaining that stability and capacity. But you hit a good point here. We can take the approach that the goal is to maintain as much capacity as possible and ICU beds and ventilators. That is certainly important. But what that only guarantees is that if you do get ill and to that level of illness, you'll have a bed to be in and a ventilator. What we should be doing is what experts have stated from the very beginning: everything we need to do to interrupt the transmission of the virus from one person to another. The way to avoid serious illness is to avoid infection. The way to avoid death is to avoid serious illness and hence infection. And I think that's an approach we need to adopt wholeheartedly now and do so on a regional level.
That is Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone. Always great to have you. Thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
The Commonwealth's eviction moratorium ends on Saturday. Governor Baker initially extended the ban from its original deadline of August 18th, but won't do it again. Instead, this week, the governor announced a $170 million eviction diversion initiative for tenants and landlords. Critics say that isn't nearly enough, and the ban should be extended to the end of the year. So let's talk about that. Are you worried about the possibility of eviction? What questions do you have about what you can do to prepare or to get help? And what do you think the state ought to do? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We're going to begin our conversation with State Representative Mike Conley, who represents the 26th Middlesex District. State Rep Conley, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thank you, Tiziana.
So you have called on Governor Baker to extend the current eviction and foreclosure moratorium. He has said he's not going to do that, that it's going to expire on Saturday. But why do you want him to extend it?
Well, first and foremost, because many of the critical elements of his initiative aren't even in place yet. Right now, I'm looking on my computer screen at the COVID-19 eviction diversion frequently asked questions up on mass.gov. And it says that there will be legal representation options and community mediation options, but it also says that these programs will not be fully operational for several weeks and that people can check back later to get details about those programs. That's just not going to work when this tsunami of evictions begins early next week.
So I hear you about that lag and the concern there. I also want to ask, he extended the moratorium once, and is there a point at which we just can't keep extending it? We have to find another solution, considering the ripple effect on the state's economy, on landlords, the level of debt that people would be in once it was lifted. How about that financial dimension of it?
Well, sure, you know, there's a point to be made there, but a couple of points I would highlight. On the one hand, the Centers for Disease Control has issued an order where they've articulated that as a matter of policy, there should be no evictions of COVID-impacted tenants for the rest of this year. Also, you know, the money is very much welcome. The $171 million that the governor announced, a lot of these funds came from the CARES Act. The legislature took action earlier this year to give the governor flexibility with this money. But frankly, this money should have been released sooner, and it would make a lot more sense to keep the moratorium in place and let that money go to work in the coming weeks and months before we start to see up to 200,000 evictions. And that was the high estimate provided just yesterday. It was reported that the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Trial Court thinks we could be facing up to 200,000 evictions.
So let's stay on that for a minute. We talked to Doug Quattrochi earlier today with Mass Landlords, and he agrees on the needs for solutions. But to a point that you made at the beginning of that last answer, he says we don't need to panic before the October deadline. Here's what he had to say.
at the highest possible level, there's no need to panic and act something quickly, because the CDC moratorium has 86% of renters covered nationwide. You can't be evicted if you can't pay rent due to COVID through the end of this year. And it's 100% of low and moderate income renters.
So you made the point as well that many are covered by the CDC moratorium. So why not extend the moratorium for landlord's sake, but use the $171 million, and again, not all of that is actually in rent support, but to support those who aren't covered by the CDC moratorium?
Well, you know, it's really not that simple. For one thing, the Trump administration is actively working to undermine the CDC moratorium. And the Washington Post reported this late last week that Trump's Department of Justice has been narrowing this moratorium. And so that leaves us in a position, and frankly, I find it unbelievable, that we now in Massachusetts are turning to our most vulnerable residents, and we're saying we are going to trust Donald Trump and his Department of Justice and his CDC to offer you a very thin layer of eviction protection. And so when I reference the CDC moratorium, I think what we can do is we can look to the CDC as our leading infectious disease and public health institution and recognize that as a matter of policy, they have indicated there shouldn't be evictions for the rest of this year. But in terms of implementing that policy, we shouldn't rely on anything that's connected to the Trump administration. We ought to implement or extend, at the very least, the current moratorium. And that is a position that it's not just me saying that. The Boston Globe said that in an editorial yesterday, as mm-hmm. well as the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. Their official position is to call on the governor to extend the current moratorium, let this $171 million go to work, and let the other support pieces actually get ramped up and running and make them available to everyone.
Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. Lynn is on from Tewksbury. Lynn, you are on with State Representative Mike Connolly. Go ahead.
Hello, Representative. Thank you for having me. My point on this is I'm really kind of sick and tired of the people always being the ones to have to bail everybody out, including the banks. Every 10 to 15 years, something happens, we have to bail out the banks. It seems to be a pretty regular pattern. I think they really just need to eat the loss this time. And I think we should just tell them, no, you're not getting those mortgages. You're not getting those rates from the landlords, and then the landlords don't have to collect from their tenants. And that leaves the only things being owed as tax and utility. Those are things we can work with, but I think it's about time the banks ate it and took a loss for once. Because no matter how bad it gets, they always come out ahead. I think they need a loss this time.
And let's go back to you, State Representative Connolly.
You know, I sympathize with that statement. You know, there have been reports that, for example, billionaires have increased their wealth by hundreds of billions of dollars since this pandemic started. And to be clear, the $171 million announcement by the governor, again, that's a welcome step. The lion's share of that money, most of it will wind up either supporting landlords or wind up with the banks. And certainly our small landlords do need support. But, I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, particularly in this COVID-19 economic crisis that has disproportionately impacted those at the lowest end of the economic spectrum.
You expressed some frustration earlier that the governor had not made more money available and gotten ahead of this sooner. The State House has also not acted sooner. I mean, we're still facing the end of this moratorium on Saturday. You were at the State House today trying to get an emergency petition considered. And one of the things you tweeted in part was, quote, the emergency petition was sent to the Senate for concurrence. However, the Senate has already adjourned for the weekend, so I just doubted the presence of a quorum and shut down the House to protest 11 weeks of inaction, unquote. Did you think you'd be able to get the Senate and the House to pass something, or was your work there today symbolic about what's going on?
You know, I think it was certainly an uphill battle to think that one representative could pass an emergency law in one day. But for me, it was really a matter of conscience. You know, I mean, I consider myself to be both a legislator and an activist in the fight for housing justice. I was raised in public housing out in Norwood, Massachusetts. I'm a lifelong renter. And so, for me, I couldn't sit idly by as we now go on 3 months of no formal legislative sessions, no debate, no roll call votes on Beacon Hill. There was one final informal session of the House of Representatives today. And with people out in the streets here in Massachusetts, there's video today. Protesters have actually shut down courthouses in Kansas City, as I understand it. They've chained themselves to the doors to stop evictions. So this is a national crisis. For my part, I have the privilege of serving in the legislature. I wanted to be there doing everything I could just so I could look back and say I didn't leave any stone unturned before this eviction tsunami takes over in the coming days.
In our last minute or so, an investigation by WBUR found that there are landlords who have been circumventing the current moratorium, and State Attorney General Maura Healey told us they've received more than 200 complaints from tenants. Is that something that you are looking into or acting on?
It is, and you know, I have referred complaints to the Attorney General. The Attorney General's office has been terrific in enforcing our current law. And it brings up another point that I'll make quickly. And this is a big problem. Just because a tenant qualifies for rental assistance does not mean that a landlord has to necessarily cooperate. And that is, you know, we need to pass legislation to guarantee a right to cure if a tenant falls behind. We can be in the situation where a landlord can say, I don't want to accept the RAFT money or the rental assistance money. I'm just going to do an eviction anyway. So that's a problem. And then a whole other problem, final thing I'll say, is there's the whole matter of informal evictions. You know, if people actually end up in the housing court with an attorney working out a deal with their landlord, that, you know, that could be a pretty positive situation. The thing that concerns me the most is now that this headline is going out that the moratorium is lifted, vulnerable tenants, sometimes non-English speakers, will be getting these very threatening notices to quit from their landlords. And our frontline housing service attorneys tell us they're, in many cases, end up feeling pressured or compelled to just abandon their housing, relinquish their rights. And in this time of COVID-19, we know that is ultimately going to lead to more spread of the disease and more death. And so that's why so many people are taking this so seriously. So I'm once again just appealing to the governor, extend the moratorium, give us all the chance to start to put these pieces in action and do the best for the most vulnerable here in Massachusetts.
And that's State Representative Mike Conley, who represents the 26th Middlesex District. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So let's turn now to somebody who can answer questions and give us an idea of the resources available now through the state to those who are affected by the end of this moratorium. And if you have questions about resources, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephanie Cox joins us now on the line. Stephanie is the executive director of the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts. Welcome, Stephanie.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
So let me just give you a chance to first react to what we heard from State Representative Conley and his conversation with the caller and his conversation with me.
Well, certainly, I appreciate all the effort and intentions that have gone into the representatives' advocacy. And certainly, when it comes to the resources that are available, I want to clarify that the Emergency Rental and Mortgage Assistance Funds that can be used to stay in your home, while it's true the landlord has a choice in the matter of whether or not to accept it, those funds can also be used for someone to put towards first, last, and security at a new place. And there's other resources such as Homebase. If somebody simply has no ability to pay at all moving forward and they need a new place, they can use that fund to have sustainability, you know, for rent over the next several months, potentially up to a year. So there are actually a lot of resources available for tenants.
So what should people be doing now, right now, if they are concerned or believe they are at risk for eviction after the 17th?
Well, first and foremost, if you or someone you know is in risk of losing your home, whether you're behind in the rent now or you think that you may be, it's really important to apply immediately. So you can go to mahousinghelp.com, and that's where you can find out about the RAFT program and other resources and how to start the application process and what to expect. But we are dealing with pandemic level demand. There are a lot of families ahead of you. And so it's important not to wait. You don't want to get that notice to quit or that court summons, as the representative referenced. That, you know, we really encourage people not to wait, to go ahead and apply for assistance. There is also, as this new, the CDC moratorium is taking effect, there are certain requirements under that that didn't exist under the state moratorium, including that you have to fill out a form and give it to your landlord that attests that you are applying for assistance and that you're making a good faith effort to pay. So for example, if all you can afford of your rent right now is $300 a month, but you're paying that $300 a month, that is something that will help to protect you moving forward. There's a lot of other resources on the state's COVID-19 housing help website as well that can help families and individuals who are trying to navigate this process. And in the coming weeks, the Housing Consumer Education Centers across the Commonwealth will be packaging various services such as mediation, access to attorneys, and along with these financial resources that would be available for people.
And again, that's masshousinghelp.com. And listeners, we will put a link to that on our webpage at radioboston.org. So I want to ask, let's take a step back for a second, Stephanie. We are 7 months or so, depending on where you count, we're even longer into the pandemic and the ensuing economic crisis. If we had not had a moratorium through October 17th, how long ago would we have reached a crisis point in evictions? Give us a sense of what is pent up behind this dam.
It's really hard to gauge that. I think that's the million-dollar question that everyone from the courts to the governor's office to our agencies have been trying to answer. Because when there is no legal mechanism there, then and if people aren't walking through our doors, we don't know. Certainly, there is an estimate that there's probably about 11,000 odd evictions that are just simply in the backlog that normally would have proceeded in non-COVID times on a monthly basis through this period. So
I'm sorry, I just want to qualify, 11,000 evictions per month during this period under normal circumstances?
No, total.
Total. Okay,
so,
thank you.
So if we hadn't had COVID and things had continued along under normal circumstances, there probably would have been somewhere in the range of about 10 to 11,000 odd evictions that would have happened normally. Now you add COVID on top of that, it could be anywhere from 20 to 60. I mean, there's a pretty broad range, and it's hard to ascertain that because there's not a lot of great data about default rates when it comes to just non-payment of rent.
Stephanie, I'd like to get a call in here, 800-423-8255. We've got Samantha on the line from Coolidge Corner. Samantha, go ahead.
Hi, yes. My comment is that it seems like a shame that people would be evicted in such a low demand market for rentals, and then because we'll have people kind of out on the street and then empty apartments.
Thank you for that call, Samantha. And I'll bring it back to you, Stephanie Cox, and say, with that in mind, and I have heard other people speculate, you know, no one can afford to rent a new apartment either. Now, you've just said that there can be financial assistance for first, last, and security deposit. But what are you hearing from landlords' organizations? And is there a desire on both sides to mediate, come up with payment plans, take other approaches that avoid eviction on both sides?
Sure. So I think, first of all, it's important to qualify that while there has been people moving out of Boston and other metropolitan areas, certainly there, rentals are not qualified to, are not limited to just apartments. I rent, but I rent a house. And so in lots of different areas, landlords have choices. I live here on the Cape, where there's a really hot sales market. So my landlord could choose to sell this property for a second homeowner to live in. So I think that's important to qualify that where you are in the state matters. Secondly, I would say that landlords that we speak to, they really do want to communicate with their tenants. And I think that there's fear on both sides, right? And fear sometimes makes us not speak to one another, but that is the best thing that both parties can be doing. I think most landlords recognize they may not be made 100% whole out of the resources that are available and the current situation that we're all in. We're all in this together. And I think as far as tenants, that the more that you do communicate, and I understand there's always bad apples. There's always some, hostile landlords that are, I think, the exception to the rule. But if you do have a relationship with your landlord, it's important to communicate with them, let them know as soon as you know that you're going to be behind, and try to work out a payment plan. And now that we have additional resources coming in as far as the RAFT program, we can work out a deal so that a significant portion of the arrearages is paid for through RAFT, and the tenant is paying a portion of their income, whatever that may be, towards the rent for the next 6 months or so. And the RAFT program fills in the gaps. And that may mean the landlord taking a little bit of a haircut on the rent moving forward for the next 6 months. But I think in general, to Samantha's point, we definitely have people who understand the need for shared sacrifice in this time. And I don't think anybody's really looking to make a big profit. It's about staying afloat for small landlords. And, we know a lot of small landlords who, if they don't get help, they're going to sell that property. They're going to short-term rent that property. And that ends up hurting the tenant as well. That ends up displacing the tenant as well.
So Stephanie, last question, and very briefly, really just a yes or no question. $171 million in the Eviction Diversion Initiative. Will the state run out of money?
We're definitely going to need more money, and we'll be monitoring that and sharing that, how fast the burn rate is on that with the administration and the legislature as time goes on. But we appreciate the investment, and it's a big first step.
And where can the state turn? What's the long-term solution here?
I think we would need a crystal ball on that. In terms of the federal government, as far as resources, that's really what everyone is holding out hope for. And then if it's not that, then we have to look at other options. But unlike the federal government, Massachusetts needs to have a balanced budget. So that does create challenges for lawmakers.
And that is Stephanie Cox, the Executive Director of the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts. Stephanie, I really appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
So much has changed during the pandemic. For many, work is remote. Kids are Zooming to school, and family, FaceTiming grandma now. Now, many of these changes will stick even after a vaccine. And Harvard Business School's Deborah Spar says that that's not surprising. She argues that how we live, love, and work has always been driven by our technological advancements. Her new book is Work, Mate, Marry, Love: How Machines Shape Our Human Destiny. She'll be participating in a Boston Book Festival event, of which WBUR is a media partner. Professor Deborah Spahr, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm glad to have you. I am a fan of a good brain bending, and your book definitely, it bent my brain. I have never been confronted with the idea that our relationships, gender norms, concept of work is and who does it, all of it driven first and foremost by technology. Can you explain that idea?
Sure. So I should first say I wrote this book way before COVID hit, but I think COVID is bringing the argument into very sharp relief, because what I'm suggesting here is that all of our most intimate relationships, how we get married, how we have children, how we fall in love, all of those things at a deep level are being driven by technological shifts. And what I mean by that is that we all live in a particular moment in time. And the moment that we're living through is itself the product of certain technologies. And as those technologies change, our social structures change accordingly. If you look at how we live today and compare it to how we lived as human beings during the Industrial Revolution or way back in time, you can see that we live in fundamentally different ways because of the technologies that surround us.
So let's anchor people in the full breadth of what you mean by technology. You actually start all the way back with the plow, which actually surprised me. I think I was expecting fire, although you explain why you didn't start with fire in the book. How could something like the plow be more formative in our cultural practices around, again, gender roles, love, procreation, property, than say what we believed about the gods at that time, or about our bodies, or about whether the planets revolved around the sun or the sun around the planets?
Well, all of these things are important, of course, but the plow is particularly crucial. And I love telling the story of the plow because it's so obscure and people don't know it. But if you look across the really broad sweep of human history, for most of our time on this planet, we were hunters and gatherers. We didn't have private property. We found our food. And then over thousands of years, technologies began to change. And crucially, our ancestors developed plows and other technologies that enabled them to grow food rather than finding it. This was humankind's first great technological revolution. And once you shift to farming, kind of everything else changes. We won't have time to get into it now, but even the gods change, and how people thought about the gods changed when you start to grow food. And one of the first things that happens, of course, is you need private property. When you're growing food, you need private property. You need to own your seeds. You need to own your land. And crucially, you need children. So children become valuable, not just because one is emotionally attached to them, but because you need the labor. And crucially, you need children to inherit the land once you die. And so if you take the argument one step further, for the first time in history, men need to know who their children are. And the only way for a man in 8,000 BC to know who his children are is for that man to have sex with a certified virgin and to ensure that she never has sex with anybody else for the rest of her life. And that, without much romance, I'm afraid, is the history of marriage. And it's an institution that arose in a particular moment of time to solve a particular set of problems.
So there's 800 things that, of course, that evokes everything from the idea of a certified virgin to, wait, how can you know for sure, right? Which begat which, but the chain of events you just laid out is pretty convincing. So I want to jump forward. Farming lasted a long time, but eventually we get to the Industrial Revolution, which you focus on substantially as well. And I often ask this question, how big a deal is it? How big of a deal was the Industrial Revolution in rewriting humanity?
It was huge. I mean, if you look again in this very broad sweep of time, there have been three major technological revolutions: the agricultural, the industrial, and the one we're living through right now. But the Industrial Revolution, one of the things I find most intriguing about it is it created the whole idea of a future, which is hard for us to get our minds around. But prior to the Industrial Revolution, people didn't even think of the future, really, because their lives were going to unfold more or less the way their parents and grandparents had. They were going to live in the same village, farm the same land, live the same way. The Industrial Revolution creates the whole idea of change. And you can think of it because it wasn't even all that long ago. You're living in this teeny tiny little village and, you know, railroads come to the village. And in one generation, people saw that change. Even more important than railroads, of course, was factories. You didn't have factories before the Industrial Revolution. And what factories do, in addition to obvious things like creating cities and pollution, they create a labor force, a wage labor force. And so, for reasons I won't go into now, eventually it happened that the bulk of the wage labor force was men. So men became the paid wage earners, and women became those who stayed home. So gender relationships and family structures change as a direct result of these railroads and factories that came out of the Industrial Revolution.
So let's stay right there for a minute, because that gives me a way to ask another question I wanted to ask you. You just talked about the change in gender roles. Men earn wages, women stay home. I said before, I enjoy a good brain bending, but that doesn't mean that in getting my brain bent, I don't get uncomfortable or find something troubling. And parts of this book were both for me. You talk about forward progress, and forward in my mind as a word has a moral dimension to it. But that example you just gave, some would not experience as morally forward. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So, yeah, of course.
So how do you grapple with that?
Well, I think we would all like to believe that the narrative arc of history moves in a moral direction, but I'm not sure it always does, or it certainly doesn't do that of its own volition. I mean, machines don't have a morality. Technology doesn't necessarily have a morality. It's up to us as humans to put the rules in place, to impose our morality on the machines that we create. I think if you take my argument and believe it to be even partially true, then it suggests that those of us who are living through the digital revolution have a moral obligation to try to bend this arc of history in a moral direction. And just to give one of, you know, a million different examples, you know, if we had cyberspace to do over again, we probably should have put some rules around it back in the 1990s. We probably should have thought about who owns data and what rules of privacy and what 6-year-olds can see online is something that we might have wanted to put rules around rather than just leaving to the market and the technology to find their way. If we look at what's happening right now with all of us working on Zoom, as you mentioned at the outset, we know right now that women are being disproportionately affected. Women are dropping out of the workforce. So yes, technology is causing that, but we have the ability to reshape how we respond to the technology. So my book is, you know, at a sort of a deep level, two-pronged, that I'm saying technology determines lots and lots of things, but we, the humans, still control the technology. So if you can understand where technology is heading, that's when you can start to put some moral guidelines and some legal guidelines around it.
So that gets to another argument I was kind of having with you in my head while I was reading the book, which is that, now, obviously, you've studied history in a way that never in my entire life will I. So with my limited knowledge, it seems to me that often we have a contractive response to technological advancements as well. So one might argue that nationalism is a response to globalization, for example, that when we push people fast to change socially and culturally, we actually seek to contract, to go backward. And where does that fit in this landscape? And how do we think about that right now and today? I mean, everything right now happens against the backdrop of a general election that is certainly culturally disruptive this year.
Yeah. So that's a great set of questions. I think you've read more history than you want to acknowledge. But for sure, you're exactly right. We as human beings are actually quite conservative, that we think we want change. We want change in the abstract. But then when we realize that change is actually going to affect us personally, we recoil from it. And I think it clearly there's a million different things going on right now. But this is a big part of what's going on right now politically, that we are going through, we societally, every one of us is going through a massive technological change. And it's affecting us in ways that are unsettling and are disturbing and are scary. And so at a deep subconscious level, it's not surprising that a lot of people are retreating to nativism, tribalism, conservatism, to bringing back the old ways of life. There's different words put around that. But we are seeing what, you know, in a flippant way, you could call a Luddite reaction. The argument I would like to make, at least, is to sort of underscore that this is a Luddite reaction. And I don't mean that in the flippant way. I mean it in the way that it is a response to technology. So some of the things that are sort of out there and painted as a response to immigration, a response to feminism, a response to transgender rights, I think at their core are reactions to technological change. And it's scary. And so we retreat into the past rather than figure out how best to embrace and shape the future that's going to come whether we want it or not.
Is there something fundamentally different about AI and algorithms than anything we've seen in technological history in its ability to bake things into our cultural practices and our lives that we might not be able to undo or change or guide?
Well, I do think there's something fundamentally different about AI. You know, I don't think it's categorically different, but it's a major step change. And I would argue a little bit with the second half of your question, because I think many technologies have reshaped our culture. And, you know, going back to our early conversation, the plow created sort of culture as we know it. The Industrial Revolution created urban culture and work culture. So AI and machine learning and all of those things will continue that trajectory of reshaping culture. But what's different about this one, and the reason why I think this one does sort of stir up these deep fears in us, is that this is the first time in history when we're on the cusp of building machines that could be smarter than we are. And, you know, there's a reason why science fiction is full of examples of robots and AI, because that is, at some level, the final frontier. It's no longer that we're reshaping just human culture. We may be reshaping humanity. And that's scary. I mean, it's exhilarating and fascinating, but it's also fundamentally scary.
All right. And our last little bit, my last question. Somewhere in the book, you talk about the fact that it's dangerous to peer too closely into the future. And yet, you know, this book is a framework for us to think about, about where we're headed. So, you know, in 30 seconds, because I'm going to make it as hard for you as possible, where are we headed?
I think we're at an inflection point that we are approaching a period where the role of humans as producers is really going to be up for grabs. For all of our history, we've been scratching out an existence, feeding ourselves, clothing ourselves. We don't need our own labor to do that anymore. We have machines to do most of the things that have characterized our identity kind of forever. Keynes raised this question amazingly back in 1930. What will happen to humans when we don't need to work anymore? And we can answer that in a positive way. We can develop philosophies and cultural pursuits and write poetry, or we can stumble into the dystopian future. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but it's going to happen in the foreseeable future. And that's a decision or a path, a critical path in the road that we have to figure out how to take the right way.
Deborah Spahr is a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, former president of Barnard College, and the author of a number of books, including her latest, Work, Mate, Marry, Love, How Machines Shape Our Human Destiny. She'll be participating in a Boston Book Festival talk next Wednesday, of which WBUR is a media partner. Deborah Spahr, thanks for joining us today.
This is my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.